Welcome to On Trial, starring Mark Radulich, also starring Sean Comer. Hope you're ready, Hollywood, because you're on trial.
All rise. Court is now in session. The Honorable Judge Ito presiding. This is On Trial. It's the only judge I can ever remember. You'd think I'd remember Handy Harry Anderson, considering we use the Night Court theme, but nope, Judge Ito, because the 90s.
Rest in peace, Mac.
Yeah, right. This is On Trial. I'm your host, the mandated reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified, Mr. Mark Radulich. Prosecuting this evening's proceedings is Sean Comer. How do you do, sir?
Sure as there's coffee in my cup and salt and pepper in my beard with a hoodie on my back, the good times is here.
See y'all. On the docket tonight is Space Jam from 1996, starring Michael Jordan, featuring your friend and mine, Bugs Bunny. And we're doing this because, obviously, LeBron James is in the new Space Jam sequel, Space Jam, A New Legacy. So I thought it would be fun to look back on the first Space Jam, which has an interesting history to it. Did you see this when it was new in 1996, or had you come to it later?
Not in theaters, but I was a big old basketball nerd in 95 and 96. I didn't even know if I was calling myself a full-fledged nerd then. I was just a fan. I was certainly aware of it, and I saw it when it came out on video.
I saw it. I probably saw it in the theaters, knowing me. I'm in the middle of college by this point. And I'm a big Looney Tunes fan, you know, child of the 80s and all of that. The thing that I remember most about this movie at the time was I believe it was Boys to Men song, I Believe I Can Fly.
That R. Kelly. Thing,
it was R. Kelly? Kelly? Okay. Yeah, that thing was everywhere. I heard it in my dreams, and now all I can hear is the Me First and the Gimme Gimme's cover of it. But yeah, I enjoyed the movie when I first saw it. You know, Michael Jordan did the best that he could. He's not a professional actor, and I don't fault him for that. Kind of groundbreaking, you know, animation merging with real life at the time. Again, I don't know how much of it holds up today, and that's part of the discussion that we'll have. But I think for its time, it was you know, on the leading edge of this kind of film.
It holds up pretty well because the mid 90s was sort of that, I guess you call it, if there is such a thing as the glory days, of when you could be a big shot celebrity god in some other field. And the way to capitalize on that fame was for somebody to put fuck you money into a movie. And you know, and this one is the basketball star movie that makes Double Trouble look like Simon Says.
I think probably its only other like close contemporary would be like Who Framed Roger Rabbit in terms of splicing together. Yeah. The animated characters with the real life characters. And I don't know. I would have to go back and rewatch Roger Rabbit.
I would say more like it's not quite Roger Rabbit, but it's not quite Cool World.
Oof. That makes Cool World. I eventually want to talk about Cool World. It's an interesting picture, but yeah. Let's get into notes here. I will say this. The movie takes place around the time, I think shortly after Jordan left basketball in 93 to go play baseball and then came back in like 95-ish, I believe. And that's about the time they were doing principal photography for this film. And so the film is sort of a timepiece of that era in Michael Jordan's life. It actually kind of works on that level. It's an interesting little experiment in film to be like, hey, there's this window of this guy's life that we want to talk about. How about with Looney Tunes?
It's a little bit of a surreal slice of autobiography.
It really is. It's a fun film in that respect. So what are the production notes, Sean?
Well, I mean, it's kind of clever because in 92 and 93, of course, the years when Michael had won his second and third NBA titles of his first three-peat with the Bulls, he made two Nike ads, Air Jordan and Aerospace Jordan, featuring the Looney Tunes, featuring Bugs Bunny. And they were both pretty wildly successful. And of course, owing more than a little bit to the fact that Looney Tunes, as they were then and probably always will be, were just a pop culture juggernaut. And Jordan was at the height of his commercial licensing power. He would never be more influential of a pitch man as he was then.
Sure.
So Jordan retires from basketball after the 93 season. Of course, you know, depending on whether you believe what he said at the time or what's been said, it could be considered a combination of the fact that he was dealing with the tragic death of his father. There was a truckload of controversy surrounding what seemed to be a mounting questionable gambling habit. And the fact that, you know, at that point, between the All-Star Games, All-Star MVPs, Slam Dunk Championships, scoring titles, NBA MVPs, three NBA championships, had just won a second Olympic gold medal. Way back before all that, he was a high school All-American, collegiate All-American, NCAA champion. He said during the press conference, he pretty much said that he felt like he had nothing left to prove. So he steps away from the game for two seasons, during which we get the rise of other teams, specifically the Orlando Magic and Houston Rockets, New York Knicks. I'm rambling a little bit. He comes back in 1995, late in the season. And that was when discussion of this previously scrapped movie project is brought back to life. And for a little bit, they had a hell of a time getting people on board with it, because they had to somehow pitch this premise of, okay, let's see here. You want us, serious actors, to be in a movie about a basketball game between the Looney Tunes and the bald, tongue-wagging basketball man versus mutant basketballer. Is that right? That's what you want us to do here? And, you know, understandable reluctance.
Honestly, I don't know how the elevator pitch was. Look, it's Roger Rabbit getting on a basketball court with Michael Jordan. How do you – come on. It's Roger Rabbit.
But you know what? It was kind of self-aware and metatextual and self-effacing enough. And you have a director that sort of knew how to structure the whole thing and work around Jordan's limitations.
Sure.
To somehow manage to make the whole thing really goddamn entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked so well that here we are more than 20 years later, and in his entire really embarrassing quest to somehow prove that he could do anything Jordan could do, LeBron James, who on his best day is about, he's not unlikable, but let's face it, at his best, he's about 1/100th as magnetic and charismatic and fascinating as Jordan. He gets his movie, which is, you know, just more, it's more really about, look how many properties Warner Brothers owns, mm-hmm. than anything. He's just a sideman to just showcasing a bunch of different WB licenses.
Okay. So let's get into the plot of this thing. Hey, real quick, in like 50 words or less, how much of his baseball career are you familiar with?
Oh, Jordan.
Yeah.
It lasted a matter of a few months for the Birmingham Barons, who were affiliated with the Chicago White Sox, mm-hmm. which at the time were owned by then somewhat infamous Bulls owner Jerry Reinsdorf, mm-hmm. With whom Jordan had a real love-hate relationship for most of his career. Jordan batted anemically. I believe he once told Phil Jackson that at the end of his baseball career, he was batting something around 202.
Mm-hmm.
It's This was not some Tim Tebow situation where he laced up a pair of cleats, grabbed a bat and a glove, and we were all left scratching our heads going, huh, we didn't expect you to actually be kind of good. No, no, it was every bit the stunt it's kind of piss taken as in the movie.
Cool. That's what I was looking for. All right. So the plot of this thing, in 1973, a young Michael Jordan tells his father, James R. Jordan Sr., that he wants to go to the UNC Chapel Hill and play on a championship team like you do as a child. Then in the NBA, a compilation of highlights of Jordan's basketball career, which includes padding the runtime, as it were, which includes highlights of his high school, college, 1984, 1992 Olympics, and the Chicago Bulls, is followed by an excerpt of the 1993 press conference in which Jordan announced his retirement from professional basketball to pursue baseball. Meanwhile, in outer space, the amusement park Moron Mountain faces decline. Its owner, Mr. Swackhammer, sends his diminutive minions, the Nerdlux, to Earth to abduct the Looney Tunes in order to develop new attractions. Upon the Nerdlux arrival, Bugs Bunny and the other Looney Tunes take advantage of the Nerdlux small stature and challenge them to a game of basketball. It goes as you would expect. Through a documentary of basketball, the Nerdlux learn that the sports players are employed by the NBA and accept the proposal. The Nerdlux go around various basketball games in the U.S., stealing the talents of NBA players Charles Barkley, Sean Bradley, Patrick Ewing, Larry Johnson, and Muggsy Bogues, and soon transform them into a large, muscular, and talented basketball-playing monsters, whom Sylvester dubs the Monstars. That's not just Godzilla, it's Mecha Godzilla. Thank you. Easily intimidating the Toons and prompting Bugs Bunny to seek professional help. While golfing with Bill Murray and Larry Bird and his personal assistant, Stan, Jordan is suddenly lassoed down a hole and into the Looney Tunes world. Bugs explains the situation to Jordan, whom Hope is placed on as one of the best basketball players in the world. Jordan reluctantly agrees to play after a confrontation with the Monstars, insults his pride, and organizes the Toons into a team called the Toon Squad, with jerseys available for sale. A female bunny named Lola, that years later the internet will be mad that she doesn't look sexy anymore, whom Bugs falls in love with, is added to the team thanks to her talents. This drove my daughter insane when we watched it earlier.
Really?
Yeah, it did. She's not into romance of any kind. Jordan sends Bugs and Daffy Duck back to his house to obtain his basketball gear. When they arrive, Bugs and Daffy meet Jordan's dog and kids and are later seen by Stan, who follows them back to the cartoon world and joins the team as well. Meanwhile, the sudden incapacity of the five NBA players is a worldwide panic that the result is the season, being suspended indefinitely. The players unsuccessfully try to restore their skills through practice, hospitalization, therapy, and prayer. The game between the Toon Squad and the Monstars eventually begins, but the Monstars dominate the first half, sinking the Toon Squad's morale. Stan overhears how the Monstars obtain their talents, and informs Jordan and the team. Using a special plan, Bugs and Jordan rally the Toon Squad, and the team dominates most of the second half using old-school gag and Acme weaponry. When in doubt, go to Acme. During a timeout, Jordan raises the stakes with Swackhammer. A win by the Toon Squad would require the Monstars returning their stolen talents. Will a win by the Monstars would allow the Swackhammer to make Jordan a new attraction for Moron Mountain for the rest of his life. Swackhammer subsequently orders the Monstars to win by any means necessary. They subsequently begin playing even dirtier and rougher against the Toon Squad than before, leaving most of them injured and unable to continue. With 10 seconds left in the game, the Toons Squad are down by 1 point, and one player with only Jordan, Bugs, Lola, and Daffy still being able to play. Bill Murray. Motherfucking Bill Murray. From Coffee and Cigarettes fame, unexpectedly arrives and is recruited to fill the spot. In the final seconds, Jordan gains the ball with Murray's help, but is pulled back by the Monstars. Remembering advice from Bugs, he uses cartoon physics, or the lack thereof, to extend his arm and dunk the ball, winning the match with a buzzer beater. After watching Swackhammer admonish the Monstars, Jordan helps them realize they're only listening to him because they were smaller. The Monstars engage Swackhammer in a missile like you do and send him back to his amusement park. Giving up their stolen talent, the Nerdlux are recruited into the Looney Tunes ensemble, never to be seen again, and drop off Jordan at his next baseball game. Later, Jordan visits the incapacitated basketball players and returns their talent, to which Players convinced a reluctant Jordan into playing in the 3-on-3 game. 2 years later, in 1995, Jordan returns to the Chicago Bulls to resume his basketball career. All right. You know, it's not the worst movie ever, but we're going to talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly. So here's the bad and the ugly. Go, Sean.
Sorry. I forgot to unmute my mic.
There you go. Take two.
Little fun fact. There was a bit of a gratuitous scene that you want to talk about stretching the realism that was shot but never used.
Mm-hmm.
In the movie, in Jordan's final ball game, he hits a home run. Fine. I am not kidding.
would have been a nice happy ending to the baseball.
Shot and discarded.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, so to the task of attempting to prosecute this cult classic. All things considered, Mark got the easy side this time out. He really did, because for as goofy and ego-filleting and cash-grabbing and undoubtedly self-aware as this movie is, it's also really damn fun. Undeniably, it's hard to watch this and not have a good time with everything from the nice, slick animation to, again, the really kind of witty, self-aware, autobiographically self-roasting dialogue. The celebrity cameos are amusing without feeling gratuitous. Huge up to Wayne Knight and Bill Murray, especially.
Mm-hmm.
And it tells a really nice, feel-good, fantastical tale of Michael finding himself to get self again and deciding to return for one last good dominant run. Here's the thing, though. Ultimately, what it also is, despite the fact that it really works well around the fact that Jordan, of course, is an athlete and never purported to be an actor, for all his charisma, all his magnetism, and all his energetic competitive fire, for all the fact that the Looney Tunes are used wonderfully with excellent voicing and really clever modernized scripting that doesn't go overboard quite the way Looney Tunes Back in Action would a number of years later,
mm-hmm.
with trying to sound too topical and too timely. It's a bit like an energetic, superbly enjoyable gymnastics floor routine that ends with a really pretty cartwheel. Mm. When you know they had something else up their sleeve that they could have done that would have just put the most apropos of cherries on top of it. And in this case, real life provided just exactly such a succulent cherry. Settle in, kids. It's time for story time with younger sports nerd Sean. Because as I said, back in the mid-90s, I watched a lot of basketball. For as much of an avowed nerd as I am now, and don't get me wrong, I am still a huge hockey, basketball, and Kansas City Royals baseball fan. At the time, I watched just about any sport on the tube. Ironically enough, except for hockey. Right time hadn't come along yet. Anyway, but in particular, I was always fascinated by the NBA regular season. And so the 95 season captivated me as soon as Jordan came back. So allow me to start there. It's March 1995. Jordan has just returned to the Chicago Bulls, who have been fighting somewhere in the upper middle of the Eastern Conference in Jordan's absence, mostly led by Scottie Pippen and Tony Kukoc. In the meantime, as I said before, the Orlando Magic began a meteoric rise led primarily by stars such as Dennis Scott, Chicago Chicago Bulls departee Horace Grant, the great Nick Anderson, Anthony Hardaway, and of course, the legendary Shaquille O'Neal. In fact, at this point, if memory serves me correctly, they were the number one seed in the Eastern Conference and absolutely running rampant. Now, as Jordan came back, Jordan was still Michael Jordan. Even at his worst, he was still more dangerous than most in the league at just about any position. But he still looked rusty. There were flashes, flares of brilliance, most legendarily late regular season games in which finally mustering a little bit more of his old self, he in particular absolutely torched the New York Knicks and the Atlanta Hawks. But something still felt like it was missing. For starters, up to this point, since the Bulls had already retired his irreplaceable number 23, he came back wearing number 45, the first number that he wore on his high school varsity team. Everything was seemingly starting to shape up, but in the finals, the eighth-seeded Bulls ran up against the number one seed Magic, and that is where the story happens. Because you have to go back to game one. In fact, late in the game, in game one. The Bulls were seeded. Small correction. Bulls were seeded fifth. They dealt with the fourth seeded Charlotte Hornets in the opening round, including Jordan scoring an impressive 48 points in game one, and went on to win the series 3-1. The next series was when they met up with the Magic, and that was where things started to take a turn. Late in game one, while dribbling up court, Nick Anderson, who I must say at the time was actually one of my favorite gritty, underrated players to watch in the league, did something unthinkable. He slipped up behind Jordan and stripped the ball from him, just swiped it away from him as if Jordan was a hapless, distracted, caught up in the pressure of the moment rookie. Now, he was not the first player to get one over on Jordan. Not before, not after. But Nick Anderson, in all of his infinite wisdom, then did the one thing that Jordan had proven before him time and again against legends, some of the most venerable competitors in the NBA, that you never, ever do to his airness when you get one over on him. He decided to taunt him. Specifically, afterward, Anderson said that number 45 doesn't explode like number 23 used to. Number 45 is not number 23. I could not have done that to number 23. Funny enough, sometime after that, Jordan would go on to have a conversation with acclaimed and legendary Chicago Bulls head coach Phil Jackson. During that conversation, a frustrated Jordan was reminiscing on his time in baseball. He noted that by the end of his short run with the Birmingham Barons, he was only hitting a lowly 202 while wearing number 45. Jackson, ever the sometimes brutally honest Zen master that he is, told Jordan, "You're shooting about the same percentage, too. It's about time you get back to number 23. Well, game two rolled around, and in the first half, Jordan, while heating up, still looked a little bit off. But then in the second half, Jordan came out wearing a pair of his signature Nikes and the number 23. I would love to tell you that the Bulls then pulled off the series and then won the title. those of you who know your NBA history know differently. For those of you who don't, they ultimately did take the Magic almost the full distance, but lost the series in six games. That would also be the last playoff series Jordan would ever lose as a member of the Chicago Bulls, because they would then go on to win another three consecutive titles, looking more dominant than ever over the next three seasons before Jordan called it a career once again. Now, I tell you this story because this all happened well before Space Jam ever released. There was time to work this into the ending and complete that full parallel of Jordan's emotional journey back to basketball. After all, this movie ends with clips, actual archival footage from his comeback game. From what I have to tell you right now, from having watched that as a kid, was the absolutely spine-tingling moment when, live on NBC, for the first time in two seasons, we heard, with the tones of Sirius by the Alan Parsons Project playing in the background throughout the United Center. And now, starting at guard from North Carolina, wearing number 45, welcome back, Michael Jordan. Let me tell you something. There have been few moments in sports quite like that one. But in between, you could have reworked that last game with the Monstars. Instead of just having the team struggling and Jordan having to work some wacky cartoon magic to pull them up by their bootstraps, have Jordan getting absolutely stomped. After all, you've already worked in so much more of the rest of his life. His fondness for golf, his foray into baseball, that absolutely wonderful moment with Wayne Knight, where he manages in a single sentence to plug every major endorsement Jordan was attached to at that time. I believe it was something like, so put on your Nikes, drink a Gatorade, we'll grab a Big Mac on the way to the ballpark.
Dude, even my son turned to me and he was like, wow, that was a lot of product placement.
I know. And it was beautiful. And I don't think anybody but Wayne Knight could have done it quite like that.
Yeah, that's funny.
But you've already done all of this. You scripted this poignant moment between him and his dad with Michael shooting hoops in front of their house back in North Carolina, the emotional footage from the retirement press conference. You've already gone this far. Why not just dramatize a moment in the game where the Monstars are just absolutely picking Jordan apart and someone, maybe Bugs, takes him aside and says, that's not the Michael I know. What are you doing? What are you doing? This isn't why we brought you here. Be you. Be number 23. Hell, maybe even have him swap jerseys.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe why not go that far? Or if you don't want to do that, just have him slap on a pair of red Nikes.
Mm-hmm.
Go for it. It would have put so much of a nicer bow on this already shockingly fun movie. And yet you just kind of obliviously passed it up. Why, Warner Brothers? Why? Go ahead, you're witness.
Thank you. So I'm going to go on that point. I'll start there. In terms of defense and the accusation that they missed an opportunity to complete the circle on the man's career in real life and sort of have a meta commentary about the whole thing, I will tell you, as a not basketball fan, and I understand that most of the United States, you know, at least, you know, a large percentage of it are big basketball fans. I mean, it's a multi-billion-dollar entertainment venue. Basketball is sports entertainment venue. But I had no idea of any of that. And considering this is it's a family entertainment movie, it's a broad-based entertainment movie, I think the assumption that, you know, Michael Jordan is one of those people who transcends basketball. He transcended the sport. He transcended the Chicago Bulls. He became part of America's cultural experience. People know Michael Jordan without knowing a thing about basketball the way they know Hulk Hogan without knowing anything about wrestling.
If I may interject this and kind of to add to your point generously, I remember a comment from, God, I want to say it was Bill Simmons, I think. It just now came to mind. Where at one point back when he was writing the Sports Guy blog, he noted that something about Jordan was that you could take somebody who had grown up isolated from civilization somewhere in remote Africa, had no experience whatsoever with the modern world, sit them down, or maybe even just a remote knowledge of it, for that matter. And you could sit them down and have them watch an early 90s Chicago Bulls highlight, and they would instantly be able to pick out Michael Jordan.
So you don't really need the ending there. The point of this...
Maybe not.
No. The point of this movie is it's to speak to the baseball thing, but ultimately it was frame Jordan as this great basketball player who has to save Bugs Bunny from slavery. At that point, you don't need... it. Once you've sort of established he's not a great baseball player and that his calling... sent by God was to play basketball, and he's going to use that God-given talent to save Bugs Bunny from slavery. Then you just need to focus on that story. So going
glorious purpose.
Yes. Going back to what works in this movie, you know, Sean and I have said time and time again on this show that just because it's family entertainment doesn't mean it needs to be poorly written or stupid. I mean, you know, is it broad? Yeah. But I think that's always the fine line you have to walk with film is what is your audience? What is your audience? What is the audience expectation? And is this going to hit your target audience, or is it going to be too far above, or is it going to be too far below? You know, some would argue and have this particular year that Tom and Jerry actually fell under that. It didn't quite hit it. And we'll see if Space Jam continues the trend of not being able to get to that target, you know, and missing it entirely or overshooting it. And it being too heavy, you know, too deep of a film. I can't imagine it will be. I've seen the commercials for it, but and as this is airing, our review of Space Jam: A New Legacy is currently up in the archives. Plug. Anyway, moving on. My point being that I think, you know, with Ivan Reitman producing, they really took great care, and there was actually a note about this in the wiki under the development that Disney had, some would say, taken a more saccharine route in their entertainment. You know, it was very pure as the driven snow. They didn't, you know, it was definitely geared towards children and the adults who bring them to movies. So I think Warner Brothers took, you know, was taking a different approach and was like, let's try that kind of Animaniac style. You know, Looney Tunes is always, if you'll remember the whole history of Looney Tunes, they used to attach these to feature motion pictures in you know, the glory days of cinema. So you'd get a new
When cartoons before movies was just a big standard deal, as much as trailers are now.
Right. So you'd get with the talkie, you'd get your newsreel and you'd get a cartoon, and it was either Disney or Warner Brothers or MGM, what have you. Mm-hmm. And they were always geared at adults. And I think Warner Brothers said, you know, we have this property that only started being shown to kids in syndication well after we were using them to entertain adults. We really need to find that fine line again and get back to that. So that's where I think Space Jam is fairly successful. There's a scene in this movie that cracks me up even today, and it cracked my kids up. And they, you know, because my kids are such Puritans, they actually had them. I've talked about this on other podcasts. They don't like the foul language. They don't like the boobies. They don't like kissing. They don't like nothing. They like explosions and punching, and that's about it.
They're gonna hate Uncle Sean if they ever meet me.
I don't know. I've said this before. I don't know how I had two kids like that. This guy. But anyway. There's a great meta bit, and it sort of permeates the entire movie, but this one stood out to me. Bugs and Daffy have to go get Michael Jordan. It's a great little setup to this. Michael Jordan has his regular dress shoes on, and of course, because it's a cartoon world, his shoes get caught in the floorboard and pull it up, and there's a big funny scene with that. So he's like, yeah, I'm going to need my gear. I'm going to need my sneakers and my shorts and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And I need my lucky shorts. And they do a big joke about that. A pretty lowbrow joke about
which, by the way, that part is another true element. Jordan did play with his old UNC shorts on under his uniform. Yeah.
So Bugs and Daffy go on a mission, which is fun because you want to see, because in a movie like this, which is definitely framing Michael Jordan, you still want to get a lot of your Bugs Bunny and Daffy duck stuff in there, your classic Looney Tunes stuff. So Bugs and Daffy go on a brief adventure to Michael Jordan's house and they have to get his gear. And so at one point, Daffy says to Bugs, are you getting any? And second pass. Like, they wrote the scene and they're like, this is too long and too slow and not enough happens. We need to pepper this up. And so it's as if, mm-hmm. and it's an ADR line because it's completely set off camera. They're wandering around mm-hmm. the house and it's, mm-hmm. you know, and it's their backs are to the camera. And so Daffy says to Bugs, are you getting any money for all the stuff they slapped our faces on, all the swag?
Yeah, they're just talking shop.
Yeah, and Bugs is like, no, I don't see a penny of that stuff. And Daffy goes, and this is the best, we're getting screwed. Like, you don't say screwed in a children's movie. But Universal takes the same tack, you know, DreamWorks, you know, with their Shrek movies and Boss Baby and all of that.
Look, come on. You said it yourself. Puberty igniting Lola Bunny mm-hmm. hadn't she already shown up by this point?
You know, my daughter asked me the same thing. Had Lola showed up in any cartoons? And I don't know if she makes her formal introduction later.
I'm talking about just in the movie. Look, in the same movie where you have bunny boobies,
yeah,
setting off pubescent sex drive.
I wish I could have just filmed my daughter
for boys around the world, and probably more than a few girls. No, you don't really get to wring hands over Daffy Duck saying screwed. You have cast the die at this point.
So it's so funny. She walked into her when she finally does enter the scene for the first time. My daughter's reaction was fucking priceless. It's like those internet memes of like kids reacting to the Darth Vader reveal. It was one of those. It was like, oh, for God's sakes. Anyway, moving on. So all that to say that I think the movie is successful in finding its adult audience and its children's audience and meeting somewhere in the middle. I'm going to defend Michael Jordan here. For a few minutes, and really the whole basketball cast. That's probably the last thing I'm going to say about this movie. They were asked to come in, play basketball, and do something that many actors don't do. I mean, when you think about the real legacy of this movie is that most actors are not going to interact with animated characters. It happens a little bit more now, you know, with like movies like The Avengers and Planet of the Apes and whatnot, where everyone's wearing the light bright suit against a green screen, and then you're animating Thanos or the Hulk or the apes on top of it. But especially back in like the mid 90s, the average actor, and there are millions of them, don't interact with an animated character. And it's hard to do. You know, I want to say Ewan McGregor, and I know I've talked about this before, when making the Star Wars prequels, just, you know, has talked about his utter frustration with George Lucas and his directing. You know, almost the entire movie, I think, against the green screen. And it was kind of like Glenn Miller saying about zombies. It was like, there's the monster, run that way, you know. and just Ewan McGregor not feeling like he was making a real movie. And I think even Sir Alan McGuinness, funny enough, kind of said the same thing. I mean, it wasn't even against the green screen back then. It was just kind of, I don't know what I'm doing here. They just gave me lines and I utter gibberish and I swing a bat at one point and then I'm done and I'm a pile of clothes. So my point is that a lot of actors, A, don't do this, and when they do, they just find it hard. And now you're asking non-trained actors to do it and do it convincingly enough to at least bring a family entertainment audience along. And look, is Michael Jordan going to win any awards for acting in this? No, nobody is. You know, maybe some of the voice workers would, you know, like Danny DeVito, I think, is fine in his role as the, you know, as his, you know, as this character from Taxi. But
you can always count on Danny DeVito. Right. DeVito was fine. Wayne Knight was fine. So, Bill Murray had what fun he could.
Bill Murray was playing Bill Murray and doing a good job of it.
Yeah. Bill Murray gonna Bill Murray because Bill Murray.
My point being that I think it's a lot to ask of professional athletes who are not actors to go in and do things that regular actors don't normally do. And they did it convincingly enough to move the movie along to where I don't think people walked out of it, especially like laughing at Michael Jordan or, you know, or any of these other basketball players about their performance. I think everyone just kind of accepted it's going to be at a level. It was at that level, maybe a little better. And, you know, and it was fun to watch. Michael Jordan is funny in this movie. I mean, he has to kind of play straight man to a bunch of animated characters, but it all works very well. In defense of the other basketball players, like I said, like Patrick Ewing and Muggsy Bogues and Charles Barkley, like Muggsy Bogues, I could actually see in other movies. He actually gives a pretty decent performance. Charles Barkley too. Because he's the only other one where they use him in a completely separate scene from what the other characters are doing. Like there's a montage of the basketball players doing therapy and medical workups. They all kind of stay together, or they're all part of that one montage. Charles Barkley gets an extra scene where he plays basketball with a bunch of kids and he sucks and because he doesn't have any talent anymore. And they're like, get out of here, you scrub. You're not who you say you are. You're just a lookalike, and you know, you don't belong here messing with children. God bless him. Charles Barkley really does emote in that scene and just look absolutely depressed and dejected. Good for Charles Barkley. So, you know, all in all, just kind of move this along and bring this discussion to a close. I mean, it's not going to win any awards for anything. As I say that, let me double check. Nope, we're good. Oh no, I take that back. It won. It won the 1997 ASCAP most performed song in a motion picture for "You I Will."
I was so afraid you were going to say for a second that it won a Razzie.
James Newton Howard won one for a top box office film. It won a couple of Annie Awards. The song won a Grammy. It's mostly the song that won for the awards. Though it did win a Young Artist Award, or was it nominated rather for a Young Artist Award for Best Family Feature. Anyway, my point is that Space Jam still holds up, I think. I think everybody kind of, you know, comes prepared to work, does the work well, and gives you a really entertaining film. And unlike a lot of movies today that overstay their welcome, unlike a lot of media that overstays its welcome, this comes in at a brisk 88 minutes. We're into the basketball game really fast. And like, look, my kids are a really good standard for, you know, the attention span. And my son never got off the couch to go jump on the trampoline while he was watching. That's a good barometer for me that this was brisk, well-paced, and as short as it needed to be to make feature length, but still be engrossing for kids from one end to the other. And that's with all the extra footage of Michael Jordan, which I'm not sure most kids cared about. It was kind of, let's get to Bugs Bunny already. And they do. They, you know, they mix it up well. So all in all, I think if the question is asked, you know, we're putting this on trial. Does this thing still stand up against the sands of time? The answer is, I would say yes, not guilty.
Well, you know, I mean, what this movie really is a testament to, especially with, again, with the way it really plays to what everybody in terms of, you know, Jordan and the other NBA cameoing NBA standouts to how they perform is the fact that good writing matters.
Sure.
It really does, because you have to constantly be conscious of what you're doing the whole way in terms of making sure that you're not pushing somebody into uncomfortable territory to where it's going to drag the movie down.
Like, so the director of this, Joe Pitka, actually, before he did Space Jam, his other feature film and the only other one that he's done, his only other credit that I see that is in the commercial, is something called Let It Ride with Richard Dreyfuss, Robbie Coltrane, David Johansson, Jennifer Tilly, and Terry Garr.
See, not bad at all for a second effort. And you see, clearly he recognized that, because you didn't have anybody that was dragging the movie down because they were being pushed into something that really felt above their pay grade. Jordan was allowed to just be Jordan. Barkley got maybe an extra few scenes or two because, you know, Barkley is a big round ball of charisma and personality himself.
But he's not your role model.
When he's at his best. Yeah, he's just, no.
Sorry. It's the one thing I remember about him, other than he was on the 76ers. I'm not sure.
Well, again,
I can't expect to not live my life.
Well, yeah, but he was a big volatile personality mm-hmm. when he was on the 76ers. He didn't really tone it down until he got traded to Phoenix.
Okay.
And really kind of shaped up. So they didn't ship him out. But I mean, the thing is, though, is when you're writing something like this and you have that much of a task at hand mm-hmm. in terms of having such limited performers, a writer is really as only as good as their tools. I mean, mm-hmm. wouldn't you say that, Mark? Wouldn't you say that there's something to be said for having just the right tool looking over your shoulder the entire time to dot your I's and cross your T's?
I'm looking at Joe Pitka's filmography, and he's done mostly commercials, and I think he understood what this was, that he wasn't making high art, but that there was an expectation that he not turn in hot garbage. And then I think he, with a lot of commercials, you're working with a lot of athletes. I'm sure he has. I know, like, didn't he direct the Jordan commercials with Bugs Bunny?
Yeah, I believe he was involved in those. And I believe that was why he was tapped for this. So, I mean, you got to know how to write cleanly.
Hey, before we continue, I'm actually going to do these back to back. First, because we're going to end the show immediately thereafter. One of our sponsors for this show is Grammarly. Grammarly's AI-powered products help people communicate more effectively. Grammarly helps you write mistake-free on Gmail, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and nearly anywhere else you write on the web. Grammarly corrects hundreds of grammar, punctuation, and spelling mistakes while also catching contextual errors, improving your vocabulary, and suggesting style improvements. To download Grammarly today, go to getgrammarly.com/W2M Network. That's getgrammarly.com/W2M Network for free. Do you listen to much R. Kelly, Sean? Or did you listen to R. Kelly back in the day?
Oh, God. I never really did. However, I Believe I Can Fly was a choir mainstay back when I was in junior high and freshman in high school. But I loved other artists like Flip Mode Squad, Quad City DJs, you know, little Monica every now and then when it was time to really cool it out.
Cool, watch out. You got to cool it now. Anyway, if you want to hear Cool It Now sing by the actual artist, or you want to hear R. Kelly before he went nuts, or if you want to hear me first the Gimme Gimmies do their rendition of I Believe I Can Fly from their Soul covers album, check out our link in the description of this podcast for getamazonmusic.com/W2M Network. That's getamazonmusic.com/W2M Network. To get a free 30-day trial of Amazon Music Unlimited. You sign up for the promotion. You get a free 30 days. Stream all the music you want, just about anything that you could find on any other service you're going to find on Amazon and more. So, you know, make a day of it. You can order your wares. You can order your food. You can stream your music. You can watch your movies. You might even be able to watch this movie on Amazon. So, you know, click the link, getamazonmusic.com/W2M Network to get a free month of Amazon Music. You like it, you keep it, you pay the monthly fee like you would do for Spotify or Apple Music, or you cancel it. No fuss, no muss, no contracts, no biz, no funny business, nothing at all. All right, so this wraps up a whole bunch of Looney Tunes content for the past week. This today is July 22nd. On July 20th, we reviewed Space Jam, A New Legacy with LeBron James and every freaking IP in the Warner Brothers catalog. On Friday the 16th, myself and Alexis Haina reviewed the new season of Looney Tunes shorts. It may have actually been the last season. We're not entirely sure. And then on the 17th, we aired our tripped up trivia for Warner Brothers Animation, featuring not just the Looney Tunes, but also your favorite Hanna-Barbera cartoons and Tom and Jerry from MGM, plus some really oddball stuff like Freakazoid and whatnot. My dad's on that show. He didn't know a lot of answers, but he's there. He tried. Tripped up trivia is really fun. Jesse and Alexis do a really good job of it. There's one for female superheroes from back in June that they did for Black Widow, which was at the time was upcoming. And then one before that in the archives for science fiction. So check those out. The next time Sean and I are getting together is actually a week from today. Hang on. Actually, you can catch an old Long Road to Ruin with me and Sean on the 27th of July. It's the El Mariachi trilogy, or the Desperado trilogy, or whichever one you want to call it. We did that one back in the day. That's El Mariachi, Desperado, and Once Upon a Time in Mexico. I'm just an FBI agent walking my beat. So that's going to air on July 27th. That was a fun one. That was one of my requests, I think, and we both agreed on it.
Once Upon a Time? I don't remember.
El Mariachi was definitely one I wanted to do. And we had a fun time talking about those, especially Once Upon a Time in Mexico. The following week, that's what I was getting to. So there's a whole bunch of movies coming out. I'm going on vacation for 2 weeks. But when I come back, we've got the M. Night Shyamalan review of Old, plus its comparison to the graphic novel it was based on, Sandcastles, which means everything else that's coming out between now and then gets pushed back a week. So that being said, G.I. Joe will have come out by then. We'll have a Damn You Hollywood review for G.I. Joe Snake Eyes, plus Jungle Cruise, which means Sean's got double duty and triple duty and quadruple duty. Because first, much to his chagrin, on August 4th, we'll be doing an On Trial for the Country Bears to coincide with Jungle Cruise.
Oh, chagrin nothing. When was the last time you threw a challenge in my way and I sidestepped it?
And then we'll be with Snake Eyes in theaters, we'll be doing a Long Road to Ruin for the two G.I. Joe movies that came out Once Upon a Time, the one with the Wayans brother and then the one with The Rock. That's all I remember.
The one with the Wayans brother and Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Christopher Eccleston, the one that didn't suck badly.
So we'll review those two G.I. Joe movies on August 5th. And then Sean, dipping back into the world of comics, Titans season 3 first episode airs on HBO Max Thursday, August 12th. So to coincide with that, in theory, will be him and Jesse Starcher talking JLA and Titans, the Technus Imperative.
Yeah,
that'll be fun. And then I turned on the buzzsaw. You get a couple of weeks off, and you get a couple of weeks off after your double duty of all that, but you will be back pretty much full time every week, every Thursday, starting with the Candyman trilogy on September 2nd.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll be doing an On Trial for Enter the Dragon. Skip a week, an On Trial for a movie called American Satan. I'll tell you more about that offline, but this is going to be fun. This is going to be a fun one. And then finally, Chris Bailey. I'll stop here with this one. In October, we will be doing a Long Road to Ruin for the Dalton Bonds to coincide with No Time to Die. And then I almost took this off the schedule, but Sean was like, you motherfucker. No, you don't neither. So we're going to be doing Halloween Resurrection and On Trial for that. No, sorry, that's not the one. It was Resident Evil. That's the one you were like, no. And then I got two more to announce real quick, and then we'll be done with the plugs. We'll be doing an On Trial for the original Dune to coincide with Dune. And then we got a special one lined up. I think only the director's cut is available from what I've seen, but whatever version is available is the one we're going to review. In honor of the 20th anniversary of Donnie Darko, we talked about this when we we're going to do an On Trial. It will air on the anniversary. October 26th will air our On Trial for Donnie Darko.
Shit is gonna get weird. You have no idea how tempted I would be to get my hands on some good edibles to nosh on while I watch this movie for the first time in a good 10 years.
So that's all the Sean and Mark stuff, plus a few extras related to what we're doing tonight. That's going on these days. You can check out for the rest of our stuff on any Apple, on any podcatcher you enjoy listening to podcasts on. We also have videos up on YouTube, both the audio only versions and ones with our pretty faces. All right, Sean, do your plugs and let's get out of here.
Hey, I'll throw out kind of a surprising one. Since we've been talking this entire time about Looney Tunes, I will tell you right off the bat, if you really want to have an outstanding, detail-laden, colorful conversation about Western animation, if you've never listened to her anywhere on the network or, you know, caught up with her anywhere else at conventions or anything, the first person I would send you to is Alexis Haina. I can't remember what the hell her Twitter is. Mark, if you want to throw it up,
every single thing she's on, go click. Like I said, this is airing Thursday. Yeah. We've already done our new legacy. Her Twitter's in there.
Yeah. By all means, go hit her up on Twitter. Go find her on Facebook. I guarantee you, once you get her talking about classic Nickelodeon or Warner Brothers or Hanna-Barbera or Tex Avery, I speak from having known her for a whopping 21 years, you will come away having learned something fun and probably have jotted down at least about a dozen different shows that you have to go to your nearest streaming service or your nearest...
She was great on the trivia show.
Or your nearest physical media retailer and track it down. Cannot recommend her highly enough. Just full stop. Anyway, otherwise, if I've managed to entertain and inform you, my Twitter handle is right there at the bottom of the screen. I am at Comer Codex. I am also there on Instagram as well, if you really, really happen to like food porn. Or if you want to catch up with me engaging in my very first love, which is gaming, I am on Twitch about 3 to 4 times a week at twitch.tv/ComerCodex. I'm trying to stick with that for right now and find a comfortable schedule and then maybe expand to it as an audience maybe grows and then perhaps. But usually you can find me there Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday nights playing a combination of competitive games, most notably NetherRealm Studios fighting games, Overwatch and Apex Legends, or story-based games, such as right now we're working on a combination of BioShock 2, so we can then move on to Mass Effect 2 from there. I don't have a perfectly set schedule yet, so the best way to find out when I'm going to be streaming, the two best ways are to, number one, hit me up at Twitch, follow, or subscribe if you happen to have a free Amazon Prime subscription, you know, gathering some dust bunnies in your pocket there. Just, you know, pluck it out and just drop it my way. Hit the notification bell icon so you get dinged anytime I go live. Or you can follow me on Twitter at Comer Codex, because I will always send out a tweet both an hour before and right when I go live, letting you know exactly what I plan on playing. You know, I just noticed that when I position my head just this way, with the background being as it is, I have bunny ears.
And on that note,
take a look.
Court, perfect. Court is in recess. Thanks for joining us on our review of
Space
Jam 1996. For Sean, I'm Mark. Be well, be safe, and behave.